we have a conversation with the last surviving prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Benjamin Ferencz was 27 when he prosecuted a group of Nazis in 1947. It was known as the Einsatzgruppen trial, named after the Nazi group that was responsible for the murder of more than a million people. Ferencz will also share some of the harrowing memories of when he and his unit liberated concentration camps and described how he convinced his superiors to allow him to prosecute this particular group. Also, a change of pace, we talk with the founder of Jolt Radio, an online alternative radio station in Miami. It's a radio station that has a unique blend of programs that might not find it easy to get airtime on terrestrial radio. All of that coming up on Sundial on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. It was 1947. The U.S. was still holding war crime trials of the Nazis in Nuremberg, Germany. One man, Benjamin Ferencz, was the chief prosecutor and investigator for the ninth of the 12 Nuremberg trials. It was the Einsatzgruppen trial. This was a Nazi task force that went into cities and villages after the army had already taken control of an area, and they proceeded to murder Jews, homosexuals, Slavs, gypsies, and the disabled. When Ferencz finished his investigation, he found that the Einsatzgruppen had murdered more than a million people. Ferencz recently spoke at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum at their 25th anniversary, South Florida, What You Do Matters dinner. And a warning, my interview with him includes his eyewitness account of concentration camps and descriptions of Nazi war crimes, so as you might expect, it includes some very disturbing details. We started with basically when he joined the military.
My role in the campaign was minimal, in that I was unable to get into the Air Corps where I wanted to go because I was very short, and they said my feet won't reach the pedals. I tried to go as a navigator, and they said I had a bad sense of direction, and if I was told to bomb Berlin, I'd probably end up in Tokyo. At that time, I was just finishing my law school, Harvard Law School, and I had done the research for a professor on war crimes. We were familiar with what was taking place inside Germany, but we had no mechanism to deal with it. So my role in the Army, if it had any significance when I wasn't doing KP or washing the toilets, it was when I was assigned as a war crimes investigator when we were deep into the war. I had already landed on the beaches of Normandy with the 115th AAA gun battalion. I had seen the glories of war in the form of dead soldiers wearing American uniforms floating in the sea face down, and what happens when we advance in General Patton's army by destroying the cities in front of us, killing everybody who was in the houses that we saw lying in the road. I didn't find all those experiences very exhilarating.
What were some of the places in Europe where you did fight? You talk about Normandy. Where else did you go?
I was with Normandy until the final Battle of the Bulge, which took place in Brussels. We went through the Maginot Line and the Siegfried Line, and I crossed the Rhine on a pontoon bridge driving a jeep. I was in the final Battle of the Bulge in freezing weather, where the Germans had counterattacked and locked in the 101st Airborne Division. So I was there for all of that stuff. But my job toward the end of the war was to get into the concentration camps as they were being liberated, because the government of the United States had decided, as the British as well, to have war crimes trials and had warned the Germans. But nobody knew anything about that. So I was transferred as a corporal to the Judge Advocate Section in General Patton's headquarters. And the colonel there said, you've been forwarded, your name has been forwarded from Washington. We have orders to set up a war crimes branch. What's a war crime? So I think I was the first man in the United States Army to deal with war crimes. And that experience, of course, has never left me.
And, you know, something you said a moment ago I wanted to ask about is, as you're arriving in Europe, you sort of already knew some of the stuff that the Nazis were doing. I mean, how much did we know about what the Nazis were really doing until before? This is before you got to any of the concentration camps.
I was in a peculiar position. my career goal was crime prevention. And I was studying with a criminologist at the Harvard Law School, Professor Sheldon Gluck, and he was doing a book on war crimes. And he was also a member of a group called the International Law Commission, which were refugee lawyers from the countries Germany had occupied, and they were meeting in London. And they were sending out dispatches to other members, of which he was one, so that I had an inside view. The public was not aware. We didn't know the term concentration camp, for example, but we knew that Hitler had determined to kill all of the Jews and that the Jews were being persecuted in Germany and being driven out and expropriated. So we knew that much, but we didn't know the details. Even when I arrived at the gates of the camps, when the tanks had just gone in, it was quite a horrifying experience.
Yeah, you were present at the liberation of some of the most notorious concentration camps, including Buchenwald and Dachau. Which was the first camp you visited?
The first one was Buchenwald. It was a four-camp called Gusen. And the scene there, by now I would hope that everybody in the world would be informed about that. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington and other similar museums in other parts of the world have absolute clear proof. Dead bodies lying all around the floor. You can't tell if they're dead or alive. The crematoria going, the glow of human flesh, the stench, the disease rampant in the camp, dysentery and vomiting and people crawling into piles of garbage trying to dig out a morsel of food. All that I have seen very up close, and as I was investigating war crimes, we also had crimes committed against American soldiers who had made a crash landing on German-held territory. They were almost invariably beaten to death by the German mob. Not all. Sometimes they landed on a farm, and the German farm lady protected them. But basically, they were all being murdered on the ground. My job was to get in, dig them up, find the body, find out who was responsible, find out how it happened, where were the witnesses, and prepare the cases for military trials, which later took place.
Yeah, you had to do all this investigating. I mean, who were some of the people that you were talking to, and how were you gathering that information?
I didn't ask the people to give me their calling card. I got them into a room and said, everybody's going to sit down and write out exactly what they saw, what happened, who struck the fatal blow, etc. I would also immediately seize the records in the Schreibstube, as they call it, the office, where they had the records showing who had come into the camp, who was in charge of the camp at that time. They also had the death registers, who had been killed. They go by number. They got a number assigned in Auschwitz usually and were transferred to another camp. So we had all of that evidence immediately available. For example, one thing which was quite inspiring, one of these Schreibers, the clerk in the office who was an inmate himself, said, I've been waiting for you. And he took me to the electrified fence which surrounded all these camps. If you touched the wire, you were dead. And he dug up a box, and in that box were little booklets like a passport, which was a club to which the members of the SS, the stormtroopers who ran the camp, would have an evening of frivolity and dancing and so on, and they had to get their a punch into the book that they were there. And the book only held about 15 punches, after which they had to be replaced. This man, instead of burning the old ones, which he was required to do, he saved them. Every time he did that, he took his life into his own hands, because they would have killed him on the spot had they ever found out. But he knew there would one day be a day of reckoning, and he had hope that it would happen, and it happened when I walked in.
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And this is a previously recorded conversation that I had with Delray Beach resident Benjamin Ferenc. He is the last surviving Nuremberg prosecutor. He was actually the chief prosecutor for the United States in the Eisengruppen case. He successfully prosecuted one of the world's first convictions of crimes against humanity of Nazi perpetrators at the Nuremberg trials. And a warning, some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about is going to be very disturbing to some listeners. Even though you were a soldier and you were in combat, you were quite a young man. And I'm just curious, all this that you saw and experienced, how did you deal with it?
It's not easy. When the war was over, I went home. I got an honorable discharge and 5 battle stars for not having been killed. I was a sergeant of infantry. But the Army wanted me to go back to assist with the war crimes trials. The trial against Hermann Göring and company, the International Military Tribunal trial, was already on, and the United States had decided to have an additional 12 trials to give the world a more comprehensive view of how the German nation could tolerate the type of crimes that had been committed. And I was hired then by General Telford Taylor, and I was hired in the Pentagon. We later became law partners in New York, and he gave me an assignment to collect the evidence against the suspects whom we already had in prison, because if you have a suspect but you don't know where he is, it doesn't do any good. And if you have a man in prison but no evidence, it doesn't do any good. My job was to find the evidence against the suspects, and I came upon a batch of dispatches put together in a loose-leaf type binder from each commander of special extermination squads called Einsatzgruppen. They deliberately kept their name secret. Einsatz means action, Gruppen means groups. The assignment of these men, there were 3,000 men divided into 4 segments, A, B, C, and D. Their job was to go behind the German lines as the Germans advanced into Poland and Russia and kill without pity or remorse every single Jewish man, woman, and child they could lay their hands on. And they did. And I took a little adding machine, and they reported them to Berlin, where it was consolidated. I had those reports. I took an adding machine, and when I added up over 1 million people murdered that way by these extermination squads, I said, that's enough. I took a sample. I flew down from Berlin, where I was head of a group of investigators, went to General Telford Taylor, who was in charge of the subsequent trials, and I said, we have to put on a new trial. He said, we can't. We've already assigned all the lawyers to the other cases. The Pentagon has lost enthusiasm for these cases. We'll never get approval for a new budget. I said, you can't let these men go. This is a mass murder unparalleled in human history. You cannot let them go. He said, can you do it in addition to your other responsibilities? I said, of course. So he said, okay, you'll be the chief prosecutor. And so it came to pass that I was the chief prosecutor of the biggest murder trial in human history. I rested my case in 2 days,
What was your prosecution strategy in that trial?
I was the prosecution strategy, and it was very simple. I called one witness, the man in Berlin who consolidated these reports, to testify as to the authenticity of the reports. The next strategy was to introduce against each defendant the report which named him as being in charge of a group, Einsatzgruppen in action in all the towns in which he was located and from which he reported. And 32,000 killed here, 10,000 killed here, 14,000 killed here, so many hundreds of gypsies killed here. I placed those documents in evidence and said, okay, you go ahead and answer the charges. I charged them with crimes against humanity. I mentioned genocide for the first time in a criminal prosecution. And convicted them all. They went for about 5 months with their lies and alibis. They couldn't stand up to the best evidence in the world, contemporaneous documents from the perpetrators to their higher commands, top secret documents, and I had it. And they had it too. They were all convicted, and 13 of them were sentenced to death.
And you said that this is the first time, you think it was the first time that you ever used the word genocide. Was it also the first time that the legal concept of crimes against humanity was used?
No, crimes against humanity is an old concept which had been discussed in 1889 in Hague agreements. The conscience of humankind, it was described in a little different terminology, but basically it was that anything which is so grave as to offend the human conscience would be a crime against humanity. So it was an old concept, not something that was new. Genocide was invented by Raphael Lemkin, whom I knew, because his entire family, they were all executed because they were Jews. And he said there should be a special name when you execute a whole group just because of their religion. And in fact, I made a very special point in my opening statement. Right in the first paragraphs, I mentioned genocide, but I explained also what my goal was, and I was very clear. I said it is with sorrow and with hope that we here present the mass murder of a million people, innocent people. And I went on to explain, vengeance is not our goal. And what I was trying to do was to create a new rule of law which would protect all human beings from the crimes that I saw. The people were murdered because they didn't share the race, the religion, or the ideology of their executioners. And I thought that was a horrible thing. I still think it's a horrible thing. And so I have tried to create a rule of law which would give everybody a right to live in peace and human dignity, regardless of their race or their color or their creed. And that has been my goal ever since I saw the effects of war making by my experiences in Germany.
This group, again, the Einsatzgruppen group, this task force that you were talking about, can you tell me a little bit about some of the people you know, who were part of that task force?
Yes, that's a very interesting question and a very important question, because I selected the defendants on the basis there were 3,000 men in these units who every day they went out and murdered thousands of people, hundreds of Jews, children shot one shot at a time. Some commanders just smashed the infants' heads against a tree to save ammunition. I selected those of the highest rank and the best education. I had 6 or 9 generals. Several of my defendants were PhDs. And I learned a very important thing. War can make murderers out of otherwise decent people. And all wars and all nations, they become not only murderers, they become rapists and robbers and thieves. In an atmosphere where war prevails, everything goes. And my answer to that was try to stop war making.
Again, you're listening to a previously recorded conversation that I had with Delray Beach resident Benjamin Ferenc. He is the last surviving Nuremberg prosecutor. He was the chief prosecutor for the United States in what was called the Einsatzgruppen case. He successfully prosecuted one of the world's first convictions of crimes against humanity of Nazi perpetrators. We'll continue this conversation in a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Let's go back to a conversation that I previously recorded with Benjamin Ferenc. He's the last chief prosecutor for the United States in the Nuremberg trials. He actually prosecuted a case called the Einsatzgruppen case. He successfully prosecuted one of the world's first convictions of crimes against humanity of Nazi perpetrators. And a warning, some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about is going to be very disturbing to some listeners.
Do you think that these men were decent men and they were turned into savages because of the war?
They were not savages. They were certainly decent men. I selected them. I didn't pick savages. Of course, there were always some people who are at the extremes of anything. These were all well-educated men. The main defendant, Dr. Otto Ohlendorf, father of 5 children, argued as in his defense. He said, oh, we were acting in self-defense. We expected the Russians to attack us. Hitler had more information than I had. Therefore, it was legally permissible to preempt that by attacking first. And that's what we did. It was in self-defense. When I heard recent statements in the United States coming out of Washington saying that if North Korea threatens South Korea, we will totally destroy them. That sent shivers down my spine, because on that was the Ohlendorf argument. And I arranged for Ohlendorf to be hanged by the neck until dead. And the judges, 3 American judges in the trial, said the argument that preemption is justified is not legal, it's illegal, it's not sensible, it's stupid, and it shouldn't be done. And they convicted all of the defendants and sentenced them to death on not accepting the argument, which unfortunately still lingers in other capitals.
I was surprised when I read, as you said, some of them were executed, but some of them had their sentences commuted, and some had as little as 15, maybe 10 years. Why did that happen?
the atmosphere changed. There was a political change. General Patton himself, while the war was still on, did a speech in London saying we fought the wrong enemy. We shouldn't have been fighting Germany. We should have been fighting the Russians. That was at a time when the Russians were bleeding, like trying to advance into Berlin. And I heard that. I couldn't believe it. I mean, an American general, while we're still at war, says we are fighting the wrong enemy, and the people who are dying for us by thousands every day, they treat them as the enemy. In wartime, people lose their reason. They get carried away by their emotions, their prejudices, and the effect is what we have in the world today.
You know, even one of the judges who heard the Einsatzgruppen trial described having difficulty comprehending the evidence you presented, that it was so vile. Did you yourself ever find it difficult to comprehend all that evidence you uncovered? The extermination of a million or more people?
No, I did not find it difficult to comprehend because I saw the horrors of war, and that's part of war. The object of war is to kill as many of your enemies as you can, and you kill them as Ohlendorf, General SS General Ohlendorf explained. If we kill the Jews, their children will grow up and they'll be enemies of Germany, so we have to kill them too. And the same applies to the gypsies. So it takes on a logic of its own when you have characterized your adversary as a beast, as a wild animal, or unfit for human existence. It becomes easy to just go ahead and kill them. And the Germans use the argument. They're like vermin. We kill them like vermin. We exterminate them. That's pretty dangerous thinking if you're looking for a more humane world.
And by the way, I want to clarify, too, that, you know, that million plus who were murdered was just by this group alone, this Einsatzgruppen group. That's yeah. Not all what the Nazis did during the war.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no. This was just one special group, Einsatzgruppen.
Yeah.
Einsatz means action and groups means groups. That was their assignment. Murder all the Jews, kill them all. And they had lists of, you know, where Jews were located in other countries as well, which they would have carried out had they won the war.
You know, today it seems difficult maybe for people to understand that degree of genocide. Do you ever think, do you ever worry that young people in particular aren't familiar with these stories?
I worry very much about them because they're the next victims. In my own life, my life has consisted of first getting a good education, Harvard Law School, from a poor immigrant boy who fled from poverty and persecution in Transylvania, which is part of Romania and Hungary, to go to Harvard Law School and win a scholarship for my exam on criminal law, and then to go be part of the American Army. I saw what went in action. The young people are being threatened, were threatened, and continue to be threatened as long as we still worship at the shrine of power, armed force as a means of settling disputes. For example, I have on my desk right now, today, the 2008 and 18 report of the policy of the United States Army, of the United States military forces. It's a long report put out by the Pentagon, signed by the Secretary of Defense, where they do not preclude the possibility of preemptive strike. On the contrary, we must be strong. We must have more guns and more power than anybody else. If they are advancing with their studies, we have to keep up with all that. And the most important thing, according to this report, repeatedly several times in the report, we must be sure to win. Man, I'm telling you, that's crazy. You can't win a war. Who wins what? It's crazy. They kill young people out, and they all murder other young people they don't even know for reasons they don't understand. They may never have harmed them in any way. And then we win? I can't imagine that. Everybody loses in war and loses everything. I have seen that as a combat soldier, highly decorated by kings and princes, and even the German government gave me their highest award, and the King and Queen of Holland, because I've seen the light that war is insane, and it's time to stop it. And we can stop it and must stop it, and it'll be up to the young people to say, hell no, we won't go. Spend the money not on building bigger weapons to kill more people, but spend the money on trying to help the people so they won't want to kill us.
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And this is a previously recorded conversation that I had with Delray Beach resident Benjamin Ferenc. He is the last surviving Nuremberg prosecutor. He was actually the chief prosecutor for the United States in the Eisengruppen case. He successfully prosecuted one of the world's first convictions of crimes against humanity of Nazi perpetrators at the Nuremberg trials. And a warning, some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about is going to be very disturbing to some listeners. What do you think about the fact that all these decades later, you see this wave of neo-Nazis today here in the United States, in Florida?
Well, there are always going to be people in different extremes. I don't worry too much about them. We, of course, should not encourage them. In fact, there are things, hate crimes. If you generate hate against any particular group, is a crime in many jurisdictions, and it should be. But these are extreme points of view. We've gone through that in the United States in various times, Father Coughlin and all kinds of anti-Semitic, and also in America we had slavery. We've abolished slavery as well, pretty well, but not completely. The rights of women, they couldn't vote in our Constitution, and they couldn't own property. They almost got elected president of the United States. And I never had a woman in any school of mine past high school or up to high school. The dean of the Harvard Law School was a woman. A new dean is another woman. So you've seen the emancipation of women. We've seen also the emancipation of human beings, the gender revolution, that a man can marry a man, a woman can marry a woman. All of these changes were considered impossible. And why is it impossible to stop killing somebody because you can't reach agreement? And they'll kill other people. Crime is committed by individuals, not by groups, not by nations. And if you want to catch the criminals, you catch the person who is responsible and hold him accountable, financially as well as locking him up. So we have to change our way of thinking. The days of complete sovereignty of any nation can do whatever they please within their borders or even outside their borders, that's gone. We live in one world now, one planet. I wrote a little book on that. All my things that are written are available free of charge on my website. And the world has changed, and the law has to be changed to meet the needs of the new world. And it's up to the young people to recognize that and to refuse to accept the old notions which gave them the power to kill innocent people. You know, that's what I've been trying to do all my life, and I'm only 99 years old, so I'll still continue doing it.
I got to tell you, listening to you, you remind me a little bit of another very famous name who came out of World War II in his messaging, is Elie Wiesel. And what I hear out of you that I heard out of him once many years ago is this almost like a mission, a passion, a mission that you have to try to teach people about all the horrors that you saw. I'm just curious as to how you took all of that in, because the things you've seen just are unimaginable, but that you've been able to stay so positive and focused. How did you find your escape, I guess, mentally, so that it wouldn't bring you down?
Elie Wiesel, I knew him quite well. He was liberated in Buchenwald, and I was there with the liberating forces. But I am also influenced by the commander-in-chief, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, as president of the United States, declared in a very real sense the world can no longer rely on force. If the civilization is to survive, it must turn to the rule of law. He was our commander-in-chief, our supreme commander. He was a sensible guy, not a silly kid from God knows where in Transylvania. He spoke for the American people, and he was right. And we have to keep that in mind at all times.
You were recently honored by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and there's something called the Friends International Justice Initiative at the museum. Tell us about that.
Well, I have been honored by very many things, people, governments. Some of them are more impressive on me than others. For example, when the Harvard Law School gave me their highest medal of freedom, I appreciated it because the last recipient had been Nelson Mandela, and he had spent 20 years in solitary confinement in order to earn that medal. So I cherish that one. I'm also invited to get a medal from Reverend King group soon, the German government gave me also their highest civilian award, Verdienstkreuz Erste Klasse. It was their way of the new government of saying they were sorry. The old government, the old Germans, I never heard I'm sorry when I was in Germany. But that was their way of saying, look, we know that you set up the restitution programs for all the Nazi victims. We know that you punished and held accountable some of our top leaders. And we want you to accept this award. I hesitated about that because I didn't know how the victims would take it. And I met with some of the survivor groups, and some of them were very doubtful. Some were ready to kill us for trying to even negotiate with the Germans. A terrorist group was out to kill everybody who was negotiating these restitution payments. And one of the leaders of the group was a fellow by the name of Menachem Begin, who became the prime minister of Israel and won the Nobel Peace Prize. So you have to be careful whom you call a terrorist. And the world is changing and has to be changed, and young people have to recognize that and build a new society with the new cell phones and all the rest of that, of course, which is much too much for me. This will change the world. Eventually, everybody will have the same education, and you will recognize that law is better than war, no matter what, even if there's a bad decision. So I've come up with a slogan, law, not war. If we could do that, we would save billions of dollars every day. We'd have money to take care of the students' education, the old people's medical cares, the refugees who are homeless, all the other things which we cannot do because we say we have no funds would be cured if we stopped spending the money instead on building new and greater weapons from cyberspace, which can kill everybody on this planet by cutting off the electrical grid on planet Earth. And we can do it now. How much longer do you have to wait? Yes, you must test the weapons first to see if they kill everybody? I hope not.
Benjamin Ferenc, it's been an absolute honor to have the chance to talk to you. Again, your story is amazing, and I can just say anyway, personally, that I appreciate the fact that you continue to spread the message and share those stories so that nobody forgets. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Thanks so much.
Just remember, never give up, never give up, never give up. That's the answer, how you get there.
Still one of the more amazing conversations I've probably had in my entire career. Great advice. Again, that is Benjamin Ferenc. You know what? He, again, the last surviving prosecutor for the U.S. in the Nuremberg trials, and he joined us from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. All right, still to come, we're going to talk with the founder of the alternative online radio station, Jolt Radio. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So if you want to hear local Miami musicians, local radio is not always the easiest place to find them, aside from public radio, of course. But there's also the internet, this thing that we kind of do every day. My next guest, John Kenyer, is the founder of Jolt Radio, which features Miami bands as well as a variety of other music and interview shows. And he's starting to do the same thing with video. We'll talk about that as well. John, a pleasure to finally get you in here. How you doing?
How you doing, man?
All right. What exactly is this internet radio thing that you're doing?
Well,
how do you describe it to people?
It's actually... It's funny because I always tell this story. I was up in Cape Cod once, and it was a friend's wedding, and a lot of like MIT folks, and you know, very interesting minds. And I told them, you know, the typical question comes up, and it's like, hey man, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I run an internet radio station, you know. I was happy. I explained, you know, what the whole thing's about and what I try and do with local bands and producers here in South Florida. And one of them comes back and taps me and goes, hey, man, what exactly is internet radio? Because it's not a radio frequency. So, you know, what's going on? What are you sending out there? And it made me scratch. I was like, man, that is true. So I'm thinking, you know, what am I to coin it? You know, it's I think we've got it all backwards in a way, because it's technically not a frequency. We're sending it somewhat in cyberspace, you know, so maybe
it's not terrestrial radio.
It's not terrestrial radio. It's
but you're still doing radio. You're programming radio shows and things like that. So
right, which that's where I was kind of like caught up in like in saying what you know I'm in kind of a somewhat of a limbo here. But
wait, would you just call it live streaming? Is it just live streaming?
I think so. I think you know I've come to make it make all like sense of it, and I think yeah, live streaming would probably be the best definition for it.
You what is it? You just got out of FIU when you decided you wanted to start this your own internet radio station, I guess you would say. I mean, just right out of college.
Yeah. Well, my great granduncle in Cuba, Felix B. Kanye, which wrote the Right to Be Born, El Derecho a Nacer in Spanish. He, you know, my family tells me, "Well, you're going on with Felix's legacy," and I guess that might have been some kind of passed on thing.
But I mean, was it while you were in school or just after school? And then, where did the idea come from? Was it a conversation? Did you always want to do this?
You know, when I was young, my mom used to not make us, but she used to tell us, "Hey, look, we're going to send out recordings to your grandmother and your grandfather. So get on the mic." My dad had a really nice sound system, and my brothers and I would record these kind of podcasts in a way. It was like on a cassette, and then she'd ship them out to my grandparents, and that was our form of communication. And this was at a very, very young age, so that could have triggered stuff, but. I usually tell people, I think in college, I did college radio and I was just fed up with my music director. You know, I love my music director and we still talk, but I had a different vision, you know, and I think that was the catalyst more or less to tell me, hey, you know, this is where you're going to go now.
You know, when I was going through like some of the archives, it's one of the things that kind of reminded me of my old college radio days. It's just this sense of college radio, which was a freedom from, you know, having your music director. And I don't know if that's what it was like in college for you, but it was basically, here's the stuff to play. And it was nothing that you would hear anywhere else.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, even folks that do, you know, like, you know, live radio, they'll come in and be, you know, even at the studio, they'll be, "Oh man, this reminds me so much of college radio." I don't know what it is. I guess I'm a really, I guess, liberal to a point, but, you know, I just really, really love it when people have, well, they still have the ability to do what they want. And it's a bit difficult to coin, but
how'd you start this? I mean, what was, you had the idea, how did it start? What was the first thing you put on?
I used to record, I had this show called The Alternative Hub, and that was what started it all, in college. And I remember I used to, you know, put together really, I guess, odd recordings of stuff that I heard around, and I was really, really deep into collecting weird music. And and I remember, you know, I'd put it together, had a fan base, and eventually graduated, did my thing, and folks would still message me like, "Hey man, we really want, your music, you know, somewhere, where can we find it?" And, you know, I'm like, "Well, let me see." I was traveling at the time, and I everywhere I went, it just happened to be that I found something that I needed. It was almost like it was there for me. So I was in South America in Medellin, and I remember a friend of mine came up to me and told me, "Hey man, I have a friend that runs an online radio station. It's a metal radio station, but you should check it out." So he called me over to my uncle's house, and he tells me, "Hey, yeah, you know, I'm paying for this service. It's just so expensive." And I asked him, I'm like, "How much do you pay?" And it was really like, you know, it was expensive for him because he was living in Colombia and paying for a service in American dollars. But then all of a sudden he's like, "Here's the contact," you know, and then that turned up to be the part of the servers and the streaming service for the station. And then eventually when I got back, a friend of mine comes up to me. He's like, "Hey, man, I started designing a website." So everything started adding up. And all of a sudden I went from having a SoundCloud account to, you know, getting the hang of this server and these software products that I was, they were still a bit alien to me at the time, you know, because I would ask my music director, I'm like, man, this was Miami-Dade College, by the way, before I even finished at FIU. And he would tell me, look, this is too complicated. Let me deal with this. And I'm like, oh, no. So I figured it out. And it was a bit tough at the beginning, but, you know, to run that whole server, to get everything lined up and finally go, how am I going to fill 24 hours of a day, you know?
Because it was, you wanted to fill up an entire day, every day.
Yeah, every day. I worked really hard at it. I actually built my first studio in my apartment. And that was fun because I grabbed some old computers that I had. My cousin told me, he goes, you know what? Those things will work just fine. Just buy this at Best Buy or buy this at CompUSA, I think was the place at the time. I don't think they'd closed or gone out of business yet. And I put them together, man, and they rolled just fine. So there, I started building up.
Talking again with John Kenyer, is the founder of Jolt Radio. And again, this is online alternative radio. Call it live streaming, call it radio. It features a lot of Miami bands and a variety of music and interview shows you're not going to hear anywhere else. So you get this going, and you said you already had a fan base at one point because you were playing music that just people couldn't find anywhere else, and they were really digging it. But so you get this going. I mean, that first year, you know, after it was over, what was happening? You know, you kept it going for a year. You got it going on. And how many different shows did you have? Where was it at that point?
So people started coming in for interviews at my apartment, which was very weird, you know, because I'd be sitting down and it was in my room. So it was like, you know, I built it to the way where we were looking at the wall. So we're literally like not looking at each other, but looking at the wall, interviewing each other and like, hey, you know, and I just said, you know, I need a space. So I had a job at the time that I was really frustrated with. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to save up my money and make sure that I can pay for at least a year's worth in rent. I managed to find this little loft by Tamiami Airport. It had two stories. So the top one I was going to share with a person downstairs, which was a total, he was just a bad person, you know, and I didn't know what the realtor, you know, the deal that the realtor had, but my rent was fairly cheap or very affordable, I have to say. So we moved in and this became like, all of a sudden, a lot of my friends started coming over. Hey, you started this finally. And, you know, it was a perfect time in Miami. This was around 2010, 2011. A lot of people didn't have the access to, you know, let's say if you're playing a band in your mom and dad's garage, let's say you put together a band, these kids had that potential. They wanted to play shows, but they didn't have an outlet that was close to them, you know. It wasn't to them, like, you know, other news entities and stuff like that were just a bit too intimidating because they hadn't really started dealing with that whole, you know, hey, let's put out our music, how do we do this? And we would ask them for a bio. They didn't have a bio, so it was kind of, it was in a way helping the musical community. Either they were, you know, musicians, producers, or guitar players. Had a band. They all wanted something, and it was like, cool.
So
man.
you became like the de facto place for a lot of these amateurs and beginning, you know, musicians, beginner bands.
That's
so
what
at
we
least have an outlet.
Yeah, we started noticing that. So a lot of them were like,
"Yeah,
hey,
wait. Did you try to go out and reach out to these people? They just found you."
Well, they were. It was a time when it's like that, man. When you're hungry, you go out and you're like, I couldn't believe I went to five places in one night. You know, it's like we hit up Churchill's. We went to this place. We went to, and it was just everyone was like, oh my God, there's something happening here. You know. So then shows started happening, and you know, like, I want to be on the Mice Lady show, which is another show on Jolt, and she interviewed bands and stuff, fun stuff. So it just started getting like just snowball effect.
I want to ask you about all the different shows. I mean, people can go to the website and they can see all the different programs that you have. How do you describe that, you know, the list of options, the menu, I should say, of options people have? So many fascinating shows.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know what? It's very eclectic, I have to say. There's a ton of shows that deal with, you know, they're pretty much specialty shows as they go by. Everyone just has an opportunity to express themselves in whichever way they want.
Are they employees or just people who's like, hey, I want to do this show, it'd be about this, I'll take care of everything? I mean, how does it work?
It's, you know, I was just talking to one of your other producers. I forgot, Lewis? No, you're Lewis. He's somewhere here. And had an interesting conversation because I'm impressed that, you know, it's pretty much they come in and they produce their own, they have the concept of their show. So I'm usually engineering their shows because I really enjoy, like, okay, you're going to talk and play music, or you're just going to DJ, or you're going to bring in live hardware. You know, it all depends on what they really want to do. So I kind of cater to their needs and tell them I can definitely engineer that, you know.
Now, how often do you get people to come up and just say, hey, I've got this idea for a show, give me some space?
Man, a lot. Like lately it's been pretty intense. And now we're finally going into having more producers, you know, which I was like, man, every show has a producer. That's so cool here. You know, like when I was doing the tour with Christine, I would go into all these rooms and I'm like, this
Christine
is incredible.
DiMatte.
Christine
DiMatte.
Yeah. Shout outs to her. And I was just blown away by like, man, there's at least 10 different studios in here. I run it all out of one. Yeah. And it works just fine. But it's beautiful, you know, just to see the production the way that you guys have here. It's like, I'm looking up to Big Brother, you know.
I don't know if you could call us that. I can't let you go without asking. You have now, first of all, this has been around since, so 7 years.
7 years
going. You just celebrated 7 years last September, October?
September, yeah. We usually celebrate every September. And this last year we celebrated a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Seven years going on 8.
You're now expanding to television, which is online television. You have a Jolt TV.
Yes. Okay. So we're doing, as much as I fought not doing the live streaming video, a lot of folks wanted that on the website. So we're actually revamping that, and shout outs to Oscar for doing that. So that we're going to have, like, when you get to the site, you're going to see the video casting, right? But we're also, and that's in the studio, but we also produced, I produced a show with my friend Frank Guzman called Sound Waves, which is it's a weird, imagine Pee Wee Herman meets a late night show. So we interview bands, we interview local bands and local producers, artists, and he's my plant friend. And you have to check it out. Soundwaves.
Oh, no, I've
have you seen it? Okay.
Okay.
No, but yeah.
You don't have a talking chair and you don't have a genie, but that's okay. You said Pee Wee Herman. But
we do have a gothic dolphin, and
yes,
we also have some really strange characters that you guys will definitely love. So yeah, that's another portion/umbrella of what we're doing.
John Kenyon, again, founder of Jolt Radio. Now they have Jolt TV, again, featuring Miami bands, a variety of music, all kinds of different shows. You can check it out on their website because they do have a variety, an eclectic, as he said, variety of programs. John, man, it's a pleasure to finally get you in here.
Man, it's a pleasure, Lewis. It's awesome. I love the way you go with these interviews. Very, very fantastic. And not only that, but I had a lot of fun with you. I wish we had, like, 10 hours to talk about stuff.
Well,
you know,
maybe someday you get me over to Jolt Radio, we'll have 10 hours.
I think we should do that.
All
that
right.
Would be really, really fun.
Let's do it. All right. Again, John Kenyon of Jolt Radio. We'll have more on our website so you can check it out. That is the program for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.